Hello, welcome to one of our 8 case study museum interviews for the AMM Essential Questions Program series. Over the course of this series, we're finding out how museums are faring today, 3 years after the start of the pandemic and civic unrest following George Floyd's murder. We'll be chatting with 8 different museums across the Midwest about what they've learned about themselves and their audiences, what changes they've made that stuck, and what new models or approaches they've tried. These interviews are talk show style, featuring guest moderators, and they're pre-recorded so that you can listen to them when it is convenient. And listeners will have the opportunity to ask questions of our museum panelists during live Q&A sessions this spring. So stay tuned for that. Today's featured museum is the Chazen Museum of Art at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Our interviewer is Michelle Moon, an independent consultant and content developer, principal of Saltworks Interpretive Consulting. And with that, I'll hand it over to Michelle.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us. I'm very pleased to be here today with staff from the Chazen Museum at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And I'd like to begin by inviting them all to introduce themselves. So I will first ask Christine to unmute and say hello.
Hi, everyone. I'm Christine Zicker. I'm the Chief Operating Officer here at the Chazen Museum of Art.
And we'll pass the baton over to Candy.
Hello, everyone. I'm Candy Waterloo, and I'm head of museum education at the Chazen.
And finally, Kate.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kate Womberg, and I am the exhibition and collections project manager at the Chazen.
Thank you all for being with us today. We are really excited that you are included in this series by AMM, in part because you are a university museum on the campus of UW-Madison, and yet you have also given yourselves the task of being inclusive of the wider community and really making connections between the outward world and the needs of the university and the strengths of its collection. So you're a really terrific reference for museums that are in that unique situation of the campus museum and also becoming community museum. So we want to start off with that reflection that Charity indicated. We're all looking back on the last few years and trying to synthesize the sometimes chaotic experiences that all museums have had. So we want to ask you all to look back from your own viewpoint within the institution and share a little bit from your own perspective of what your new normal looks like. What are some things you've learned in the last few years that are sticking with you, that have redirected or reframed your practice, or served as an opportunity to shift or change, maybe let go of something that is no longer best serving the organization? So I think I'll start with Candy, and feel free to mention things that we can go deeper into later, but I would love to just hear your bird's eye view of how you're processing those last few years.
A little intimidating to go first, but here I go. So, my purview is education at the Chazen. And so encompassed in education, like many other museums, is tours, public programs, et cetera. And as an educator, like a lot of the educators across the country, when everything that we do is in person, we freaked out because we're like, we can't do this anymore. How are we going to do this? And we realized that we weren't ready. And so, we did what a lot of other folks did, which was really quickly scramble, try to figure out how we can still make our programs accessible. What can we do? What can't we do anymore? And one of the outgrowths of the pandemic that we are still sustaining really relates to accessibility, and something we learned, which sounds cliche, but accessibility benefits everyone. And so pre-pandemic, you had to come to the museum to see a program, right? Whereas, through the pandemic, we started doing hybrid programs, but then as we started to get into the new normal, we now prioritize streaming our programs as much as possible to guarantee that we have that bigger scope. One of the really big opportunities that came from the pandemic for my department is that we were able to retool what tours look like at the museum. So having that really big pause gave me a wonderful opportunity to do something that I'd been thinking about for a long time, which is shifting from a volunteer model to a paid museum guide program. And so we are in the first year of that program. We're really excited about it. It's a small cohort. It's intergenerational, which is something that, as a college campus, we really wanted to leverage how we can have students and community members working together. And it's in its first year. And honestly, you know, for all the bad things that the pandemic brought, it really gave us this huge opportunity. And so my new normal looks a lot different than it had before. But it's exciting. You know, I couldn't have predicted then where I would be now in that regard.
That's great. It really speaks to the opportunity and the crisis, as the cliche goes. But I'm really pleased that it sounds like you've taken that opportunity to rethink the program delivery and even the way that you're building audience with some of these new channels and tools. So we'll delve a little more into that, I think, as we go on. Kate, how about from the exhibition's perspective? What does new normal look like for you?
Well, similarly to Candy, I think for us, how do we put on exhibitions? How do we reach people when we can't have folks inside the museum itself? And so immediately that was thinking about switching to a digital model. But surprisingly, we got back into the building pretty fast. I think by July, we had reopened to the project, reopened to the public, and we're already thinking about how to alter our exhibitions for the fall to be in a format that would allow people into this space. And so we did a couple things immediately, which was to kind of reduce our exhibition schedule. So really focusing on quality over quantity so that we weren't overstressing the staff as we were kind of going through so much change and rethinking about capacity and who was going to be in the building. But we also thought about how can we add digital elements to these exhibitions so that folks who weren't comfortable coming back right away had a way to access. So for the Bill Viola exhibition that we had in the fall of 2020, we made the video that we were showing available online, which was kind of a new thing and interesting to do with his studio and thinking about how that could be accessible, but also, you know, keeping proprietary things like how we're going to make sure folks aren't downloading that video and how to make sure that the security around that was safe. And so we made that accessible to our entire university audience, which was really good. One of the other things we did is we continued to keep that reduction in exhibitions consistent kind of as we came out of the pandemic. And we increased the amount of time in between exhibitions. So we really kind of gave ourselves more moments to pivot when these new waves of COVID were happening. But also thinking about kind of the project planning within exhibitions as a whole, with outside collaborators, sometimes having more time kind of in that moment allows you to make decisions that you maybe weren't thinking you could make because of that timeline. And so I think thinking about what does timeline mean, what can actually change and what can't change, and being really open to thinking about obstacles as opportunities to make those subtle adjustments so they're really benefiting our audiences. And then, you know, kind of negotiating with our partners and collaborators so that we can do that successfully.
I'm hearing a thread of reflective practice in what you're saying, that trying things, iterating them, pausing to determine whether to continue or retreat from that approach. I just want to reflect back to you how good it is to hear about organizations that are taking a more thoughtful pace to some of these high demand projects, because we all know how much a hamster wheel a changing exhibition program can be, and that it's actually courageous and I think an improvement in practice to take that extra time to make them deeper, richer, and find new ways to share them. So to segue from that, I'm turning to Christine because I hear the implications of all of these exciting changes. I hear payroll implications. I hear timeline and marketing budget and project management implications. So as someone who coordinates that, all of the way those things all come together for the institution, how are you experiencing the new normal and what has changed in terms of the work that you do?
Yeah, I think one of the things we're thinking a lot about is capacity and trying to be sure that we're not outpacing our capacity. And by that, I mean people, but also money, and making sure that we're prioritizing projects so that if something is important, we try to put all our resources focused on that. And I think remancipation is a really great example of that, which I think we'll talk about a little bit later. But identifying really what we should be focusing on and putting our efforts there. I think when it comes to staff, what we're seeing is a lot more flexibility in terms of remote work. We now have basically semi-permanent remote agreements with any number of staff members. If you can make the case that your job can be done remotely, you can often request 1 or even 2 days a week that you're remote. This is a huge change for us. I think back to, 5 years ago, and I just don't think that that would have even been under serious consideration. And now it's just pretty normal. We have a lot of people doing it. I think to that end too, we're thinking more about staff wellness. I mean, I hope that we've always been thinking about that, but it's becoming more of what we do, and we try to build in. So in January, we had like a staff appreciation day and had lunch and had a movie, and just trying to make time for that and not always scheduling it like as an outside of work activity, although we do that too, but really making it like part of our experience here just so that people have a chance to hopefully catch their breath. I think Kate would say their team is always so busy, sometimes it's hard to even step away for those activities. So also being conscious of like when we schedule those so that most people can participate.
That's great. And this does seem to be a positive trend, is paying attention to the experience of workers in the workplace and ensuring that they have the resources, including time and a balanced workload, to do their very best work. So that recognition is so important. And thank you for modeling that and finding ways to practice it. One of the things that I'd love to talk about as well is how all of this looks through the expanded or increased lens of diversity and equity and inclusion over the past few years. I think right along with our experiences of pandemic being quite unequal, individual to individual, we've also had a number of events that have asked all of us to question the values and structures of our society. And I know your museum is no exception, and that you've been thinking a lot about how to live by those values, particularly in a campus setting where I'm sure these are the social realities we're living in are under discussion constantly. And you are both as a university and as a museum negotiating new ways of doing things. So I wonder, back to you, Christina, can you talk a little bit about how you are thinking about building your staff these days? Any new approaches to recruiting, to hiring, interviewing, and ensuring that people once in the institution are having an equitable experience?
Sure. This was something, we've been talking about and working on for a number of years, probably like many institutions. One of the workshops I found really valuable was Finding the Keys by Art Equity, which was with Sharifa Joka. And that was really formative for me. That was like an eye-opening training opportunity. And some of the things that we took from that, one of the ideas, for example, is extending our recruitment timeline. So generally, when we have a vacancy, the supervisor needs a hire, wants a hire as quickly as possible. So what we're trying to do is slow that process down a bit in the interest of reaching a greater pool of candidates. And this is a concept that comes right out of that workshop. This is not my original thought, but as we put it into practice, one of the things that we find is that the other side of that coin is that you have to move a recruitment reasonably quickly or you lose people. So what we're trying to do is find the happy medium between the ideal and what actually works for our institution. So one of the things we started doing is, for example, interviewing before the recruitment closes. So kind of a rolling interview process. It can get a little messy, but trying to, you know, communicate well with candidates so they know where they stand, they know the status. I think we've all been on the other side of a recruitment where we don't hear anything, or maybe we never hear about a hire, and we certainly don't want that to happen either. So we worked on that, and we created a checklist for people, for supervisors. So when they are working on a recruitment, they pay attention to how the position description is written. What is the language and the tone of the announcement? Who are they personally inviting or sending it to? So these are some of the techniques that we're still experimenting with, I would say, in order to reach a broader base of candidates.
Thanks for that reference. And those do sound like important practices to examine. I think I'd like to go to Candy now to talk about how you think about the program through these lenses and about your education team and their practice as well. So if you can give me a little sense of how you have been working in DEAI ideas into your work.
So as I mentioned previously, I think one of the biggest ways is really thinking about accessibility at the forefront of everything we do instead of an afterthought. And I want to be very transparent about that, because I think that that is a common flaw that we all do. We don't necessarily, you know, if I'm sighted, I don't think about what an unsighted person might experience. And so, you know, one of the things we did during the pandemic, and I just want to mention this as a point to my point earlier about accessibility benefiting everyone, is that we created an asynchronous virtual curriculum so students could still access the collection and the museum while we were closed. And one of the aspects of that curriculum was writing visual descriptions for works of art. And when we did evaluation of that program, 99% of responses said that the visual descriptions were the most helpful part of that curriculum, which really for me opened up this whole way of thinking that I hadn't thought about before. So really thinking about accessibility in terms of how can we capture or reach as many people as possible? What can we do for folks who can't get to the museum? I think Christine can speak more to this. This is not necessarily something that came out of programs, but a facilities wide, we installed hearing loop technology in the auditorium, which we never had before. And so, but another way of thinking that I've been thinking about this is really through who are the people that are leading programs. And so that relates to the transition I mentioned earlier to the paid museum guides. And so, you know, I could speak at length, and I'm sure you could, about the myriad issues with the foundations of docent programs. But really, the foundations are rooted in inequity. And because, you know, and so being able to say that we can now pay people for their time and pay educators for their time is saying that that work is as important as the rest of the work in the museum, and also really fulfills our commitment to not having unpaid labor here at the museum. And so, you know, we now have a cohort of people who have various social classes, who have various sexual orientations, who do not look the way that our standard docent program looked. And that's really exciting. And something that, you know, even thinking about students being part of that process, you know, part of our job here at the museum is also to think about who is leaving this, like who is leaving us and going out into the world. And so, you know, thinking about how we're using students in this process too, and creating that next pipeline of who's going to work in museums. Something I say to students all the time is, if you want to work in museums, get in here now as soon as you can. Because, you know, while we're changing in the field, we still have a lot of work to do about looking at resumes and deciding, well, who's got the right experience to come into here, et cetera. And so, you know, thinking about these opportunities as educational as well, and as forward thinking. Yeah, I think I'm getting a little off topic, but yeah. And I also want to give a shout out to, you know, my team. I have a really wonderful event coordinator, Jamie Prey, who is the most thoughtful event planner I've ever met in my life. And so, you know, having somebody as well on the team who really thinks about the visitor's experience first has made tremendous inroads into just how people feel at our programs, you know, how people feel when they leave, if people come back. And that, you know, that little personal touch makes a big difference as well.
It really does. And I want to call out a couple of things that I think are emerging as larger trends. And one of those is hospitality. It's part of accessibility and really thinking about how people choose to spend their time with us and thinking about the quality of their experience and their welcome that they receive. So it's wonderful to hear you're integrating that into your programming practice. Another tool that I've been recently introduced to by Kaylee Bryant Greenwell is the idea of having an inclusion policy around programming. So thinking about as you put together a panel, what perspectives are being represented, as you hire teaching artists, as you present you know, film programs, and all of this really runs through every aspect of the programming. And the other trend is the one you mentioned of really looking at the delivery of education in the museum and who is doing that. And are we replicating societal inequities as we were with many of these older DOSA programs, these longstanding traditional programs, or can we perhaps create a more equitable museum workforce and a more professional and more thoroughly trained museum workforce by transitioning them to jobs. And I think we see that in a few places around the nation. And I really hope that we will continue in that direction. Kate, I want to, Sorry.
Can I add on to that point too? Yeah. You know, what you said as well about, you know, the who you're bringing to the table, I think, you know, when you're creating panels, et cetera, that also goes into how you're dealing with how you're training your educators. So are you still only talking about VTS, or are you bringing in, you know, emerging educators of color in the field? Because there are some really amazing people doing really amazing work. And, you know, VTS is wonderful, but it's a thing of the past, right? And so just thinking too about building that inclusion into our training processes as well.
That's great. And staying part of the evolution of the education field, staying current with ideas that are emerging out there. I think this is a good link to Kate. And Kate, as you talk about how things have changed for you and your kind of new normal in this area, I would love if you can kind of take us on the trail to the Remancipation Project and understand how these initiatives toward diversity, equity, and inclusion are part and parcel of your approach to that and the generative work and the broad-based platform you've created for this incredible exhibition, which I encourage everybody to view online, if not in person.
So I think one of the key things in terms of our exhibition program is acknowledging that, you know, the Chazen is a space for conversation. And I think there is this understanding in the past that maybe this was supposed to be a neutral conversation, but art is not neutral. I think visual arts has a really unique opportunity to think about turbulence, to think about response, and use that by, you know, the lens of history and different culture to really think about how it's impacting people now and how it's been impacting people in the past, to really kind of create a framework for thinking about experience and the human experience, which is really central to our mission. And so one of the things that we really thought about are what types of exhibitions, what types of artwork, what types of materials should we be showing here as a visual arts institution. And while Remancipation will come kind of as I start talking about this, I think one of the really important exhibitions to think about is an exhibition titled Sifting and Reckoning, UW's History of Exclusion and Resistance, which was a deep dive into the archives on the university campus to really uncover stories about the student experience and the staff experience here on campus and how that has not been the same for different types of people, right? And so my experience is going to be very different from someone else's. And that's so often not acknowledged by the university. And so Casey Lucchini Butcher, who was the director of this project, really worked with her extensive team for years to kind of uncover these stories. And then initially, you know, we weren't sure if this was the right fit. You know, this was to us, well, this isn't a visual arts exhibition. Should this really be in our museum. But what we, you know, recognized and kind of over the last couple of years realized, you know, we are the largest gallery and, you know, we are the only large scale museum on campus. And it is our responsibility to house these types of projects, to really put them at the forefront of what is being discussed on campus and give them the prominence that they deserve. And so I think kind of keeping that same sentiment when thinking about exhibitions is really important. And so this exhibition was a huge success. It was extremely popular with the student base. It had so many connections kind of across campus, and that Candy's team worked in terms of programming closely with the Public History Project. And I think that that taught us a lot of lessons. It also taught us a lot of lessons about being a good collaborator. So while the Remancipation Project was already kind of happening, and this was initially formed out of a conversation that Candy had with Mark Hines and Sanford Biggers back in 2019, when they were on site to do some programming for an exhibition at the time. And they looked at the Emancipation Group sculpture by Thomas Ball in one of our permanent collection galleries. And so from that conversation, you know, that developed, and during really the kind of after several events, starting with the death of George Floyd, but then thinking about what was going on with the Black Lives Matter movement, but then also thinking about how another iteration of this sculpture was then removed from Boston in this time frame, it kind of kicked this whole project. At the time, we didn't really know if it was going to be an exhibition, to another level, and then acknowledged that this was a moment that we really needed to respond. We couldn't just put this sculpture away and tuck it into storage, that we needed to openly acknowledge it, have an open conversation with our community and with our student base and with our staff about how to contextualize something like this in our collection instead of just ignoring it. And so I think from that perspective, you know, it gave us the spark, kind of that push to kind of really say, we need to focus our resources and our time in this direction.
That's a really organic origin for this project and really speaks to your ability to identify and grow an opportunity. I wonder, Candy, since that conversation began in your department, do you want to speak at all about that and how that made the transition into this, you know, incredibly digital, physical documentary resource that you've created?
Honestly, the dinner happened so long ago, but I can recall that, you know, it was during the dinner that something came up about monuments. And at the time we had a curator here, Maria Safiotti Dale, who was doing some initial work on the sculpture. And that sculpture as an educator was one that was always shown on school tours. And it was always in my mind because of a letter that I received from a parent. So a parent sent a letter saying, I brought a group of multicultural children here to the museum, and the only example that they see of themselves is this object where they're in a subjugated position. And so that, you know, really stuck with me and struck me. And that's part of why at the dinner conversation, we were talking about this thing. And so, you know, I just threw that out there. I didn't know it was going to go anywhere. And Sanford coming back to Amy, I think actually really speaks to the value of collaboration and conversation. You know, Kate said initially, we're a space for conversation. And if you would talk to Sanford or Amy, you know, when this project first started, I think we saw it as they're going to do a response, right? Like I think we were thinking about it very literally, like it's going to be a counter monument. That's what it's going to be. And then through these last 2 years, I mean, you know, Kate didn't mention this, but we had weekly meetings, you know, and her team, there was a huge lift on her team. Sanford and the Mass Consortium came to Madison multiple times. And so, you know, it really went from a counter monument to this living, breathing process, an experiment. And that's a word, you know, process is a word that you'll hear us use a lot. you know, we have the exhibition, but the exhibition's not the endpoint. It's the start for us in some ways. You know, it's the most public part of this project right now, but it's also the beginning of where this project can go. And just seeing how it's already been received by visitors, and just even being able, one of the really beautiful things that the team did was actually start to unpack the iconography and pull apart, you know, take this thing apart and talk about, you know, what are these individual elements? How do we read this visually? Also, who cares about Lincoln? Not that we don't care about Lincoln, but like, there's another person here. So what narrative is a narrative to tell? And that, you know, for so long, the story of that sculpture was about Lincoln as this great emancipator. And it still to some people is, but really, you know, thinking re-emancipation, I think does a really good job of shifting that narrative and getting us to think about other perspectives and perspectives that at times may not make us comfortable as white people to, you know, feel implicated in. But yeah, I see it as, I think everyone would agree that it's a beginning. It's not an end for us.
That's really an encouraging direction. And it makes me want to open the conversation around your communities and your audiences that are engaged through the museum. So I'll come back to you, Candy, and then we'll go around and around robin and talk a little bit about, have you seen during these past 3 years and through projects like this one, is your audience evolving and changing? And what is it like to do this work on a campus? How would you describe the weight of your focus on current students, faculty, and members of the community outside of the university? How do you think about where your resources go? So I'll go back to you first, Candy, as programmer, and then we'll loop around.
I personally, in my department, I think one of the things that I've observed is, especially over the last several years, our engagement with students has significantly grown. And I would say our engagement with campus at large has grown. And I think that there's a number of reasons for that. One has to do, and now Christine can speak more to this, but we expanded our hours greatly, which, you know, that goes to access. So we made the museum available more than it ever had been. We opened a cafe, which is part, you know, a really simple thing. That's that hospitality. But also our staff, I think across the museum, have done a lot of work to make those inroads to faculty, to students, and the kinds of exhibitions, the way we're changing exhibitions, like Kate talked about, Sifting and Reckoning, I feel like brought, it didn't, but I mean, in some ways, I'm like, it brought every student on campus to the museum. But, you know, but that's part of, if you are bringing things that are relevant and interesting and relate to the students, they're going to come. And so, yeah, I would say, like, I've definitely seen a real boost. In fact, a couple of years ago when I was doing tour analysis right before the pandemic, that was our first year of having expanded hours. And our tours, tours with college students went up by 70%. And so, you know, that's not an accident, right? That has to do with the cumulative work of the team, but also everything we do impacts every other, you know, department. And so I think from a facilities and admin standpoint, Christine can probably also shed some light on some of those things that we've done in that area too, in terms of boosting audience.
That would be great to hear about, Christine. I think that is a move that many museums have been reluctant to make, but recognizing that the majority of potential museum goers are busy during daytime hours, and we're asking them to prioritize museum visiting on their short weekends typically. How did you go about planning for this expansion of hours, adding this cafe? These are big strategic moves. Can you walk us through that?
Sure. This goes back probably to 2019, maybe even 2018. And I think one of the foundations of that shift was with a large evaluation project with the Bowles Center for Arts Administration here on campus. And so these are MBA students who tend to be mid-career professionals who have experience, and we work with them for a full academic year on evaluation. So one of the things they came back with is some good surveys with our student population. And we learned things that we didn't know. So, you know, like every museum, we have assumptions, right? So we at that point, we were open on Thursday evenings. So we thought, oh, Thursdays is close to the weekend. People will come. The students said, we go out on Thursday nights. We don't want to come to a museum. And we were surprised. Like, we didn't expect that. So it taught us, I think, the lesson to not assume we know the people coming through the door and what they want, but to ask them. And they also said that in general, the museum felt intimidating. So they would walk in, we had a uniformed officer at our desk. We didn't have a lot of seating. It felt very, it was beautiful, but it was kind of sterile and intimidating. And so that, I think, really encouraged us to think about how we warm that space up. And I can look across right now from my windows, and almost every chair and table in that lobby is filled. And it's wonderful. And it's, again, about capacity, because that's not an easy thing to manage. But I love to see the energy in the lobby now, because it's a totally different place. We no longer have an officer right at the front desk. We appreciate our officers, but we've asked them to move a little bit more behind the scenes. We have a visitor services person at the desk who is often a student or somebody who can relate to the visitor a little better. And kudos to Candy for overseeing that program, because it's made a huge difference in how people experience the museum. But yeah, it all goes back, I think, to evaluation and just remembering that sometimes visitors have different perspectives, and you have to figure out what that is to make a meaningful shift.
Absolutely true. And a really great testament to the power of evaluation and responsiveness to your audience. Can you talk a little bit too about, there are just budgetary and space implications to that. Did that require you to shift your priorities in the budget, or did you find it necessary to find additional sources of funding? I'm asking because I think many museums would say, we would love to do that, but...
Yeah, it's challenging for sure. We are very fortunate in that we have a very stable financial model, part of it based in university support, but a large percentage of it also based in gifts and endowment income. We don't tend to rely on earned revenue because we have free admission. We have mostly free programs. So what it required us to do is to basically what I would call like shuffle things around a bit. So when we decided to professionalize the visitor services program, part of that money had been used for security. And we found that the visitor services staff can do a little bit of both with some nice reinforcement from our actual officers. But moving toward a more customer-based focus instead of a security-based focus. So that was one way we were able to do it. Another thing to mention is that we, at one point, had hours from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. And we were called the most open art museum in the country. COVID has shifted that a little bit, and we have scaled back a bit on our hours. But we always said when we did that it was going to be a learning experience. Like, we never said, this is it. This is our final move. Let's try it. Let's experiment. Let's see what comes out of it. And we were able to use like visitor evaluation to understand like when were people actually visiting and when was the building kind of sitting sort of empty. And so we did make an adjustment to that. And that was, you know, in part financial as well, because we want to use our resources to the best of our ability and leverage them to serve people when they actually want to come. So yeah, it wasn't easy. It was like, I would call it a lot of moving parts. And also working together closely with our partners, like the UW Police Department, and having conversations about like what each unit wanted to do, and seeing if we could find a place to meet in the middle.
That sounds really important. And so, can I ask what your hours are now?
Yeah, our hours are 10 a.m. to 8 to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday, and then on weekends it is 11 to 5. But we do open our lobby earlier than that. So even though you can't go in an exhibition, there's still a lot of spaces where you can sit and study or catch up with people. So we try to make the building accessible, even if the museum itself isn't open just yet.
And I think that really speaks to that evolving relationship with audiences, understanding the needs of students for Wi-Fi, a place to study, place to have breakfast, and to connect with their social peers. So you've now made the museum familiar, and that intimidation factor, I'm sure, has gone way down. I'm going to go back to Kate. You haven't had a chance to talk about this evolution yet, Kate, but clearly that entree with Sifting and Reckoning opened up some possibilities that you then further explored through re-emancipation. And I'm wondering how you've seen your practice evolve. Is that about changing partners, consultations, working with students in these projects, faculty members? Can you talk to us about what may have changed as you go forward with your exhibition program, and what can we look forward to coming up?
I think across the board, we've really expanded our collaboration, especially with campus. And whether we're working with an outside group like the Public History Project, who put on Sifting and Reckoning, they had a really extensive group in place. They had a committee that was approving everything that spanned campus. And so that gave us a lot of access in terms of resources on campus on who we should be talking to and who we can connect with. But that had a ton of input from the campus as a whole. And also approaching hard topics, it gave everyone a bit of an opportunity in advance to understand that this information was going to be displayed publicly. And so that didn't really come as a surprise, right? We're not trying to shock people. We're trying to have a productive conversation about things like racism in America, right? And so I think the best way to approach those types of conversations is really not to try to catch people off guard, but to share the information and the facts as they exist, and then create a safe space for that kind of dialogue between different places. And so I think in addition to having those campus connections, each division on campus has their own community connections. And so that's really expanded the types of communities that are visiting the Chazen and thinking about how we reach out to campus. For re-emancipation, in terms of our collaborators, what I think is really interesting is it continued to expand. You know, it started as a conversation, it turned into an official project with a contract. But as we moved on, the re-emancipation in itself has become a community. We're inviting people, artists across multiple disciplines, dancers, musicians, people within film, so many different industries, textiles. We're also working with the engineering department on campus, looking at 3D printing. So bringing in sciences and folks who aren't really thinking of art as something that's applicable to their departments. And so I think that has really generated a lot of interest. And because this has become more of something that's gained some media attention within our community, I think just that public knowledge of this going on has brought different people. I also want to call out Candy's work with the Odyssey Project, and then also securing funding for that group in terms of transportation to come to our opening. I think doing things like that, where we're really extending an invitation, but then providing support for people to be here, changes the audiences that are going to walk through the door and really have those conversations with us. All about collaboration. With collaboration comes a lot more time in the planning process, but definitely time well spent because it truly changes the voice of the museum.
Absolutely. And another good reason to look at that pacing and timing of projects to allow for this fruition of those relationships. Great. Absolutely. Well, it's just about time for us to close. So I'd love to do a short answer round robin and just ask, you've all shared a lot of really wonderful changes, thoughtful moves on the part of your museum, and a museum really centering its community and asking about how to be relevant on a modern campus and in a modern city. So I would love for you to say, for those museums who are thinking about making changes similar to those you've made, what's one piece of advice you would give for moving forward? And I will begin with Christine.
I would say don't be afraid to experiment and challenge yourself to think outside the box, which sounds like a cliche, but our director has said that to us on occasion, and she really means it. Like, why are we closed on Mondays? Why is that? And to challenge sort of the assumptions that you have about your operation, and don't be afraid to mess it up and fail and you know, change it in the future. So I think that's how innovation comes about.
Great. And Candy, how about you?
Hey, to start small, and then build from there. So, you know, this particularly relates to you. I know that I've been in a lot of meetings with people about docent programs, and it seems impossible to phase that out and go to a paid model, but start small and then build from there. You know, just because things have been done a certain way doesn't mean they have to stay that way. And as Christine said, experimentation is part of that process. But I would also say, Christine, there's no such thing as failure. It's all learning.
True. Good point. Yeah.
Yes.
And back to you, Kate.
Going back on this continual theme of process, focus on the process and not the product, right? And I think trusting that the process will get you where you want to go, and just having the courage to expand that process in ways that you've never done before.
These are beautiful words of wisdom from lived experience. And I thank all three of you for sharing those with us. It's been a delight to learn about this museum. I'm very inspired by everything you've done, and I'm sure everyone watching will be too. And I look forward to unpacking their questions with you on our future visit. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing about the Chazen Museum of Art.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thank you.